This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. One of the real success stories from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is the percentage of soldiers and Marines and sailors who survive the injuries they receive on the battlefield. Treatment begins on the front lines. The wounded are quickly transferred to field hospitals nearby and then onto full-service hospitals in Germany and then the United States. This hour, we'll talk with a corpsman, a nurse, a combat surgeon, and a psychologist, all of whom served in Iraq. We'll hear them describe what they do and how, what works, and what still needs to be improved. If you or a family member served in Iraq and Afghanistan and received medical treatment there, give us a call. Tell us what it was like and what worked and what didn't from your vantage point. Our number, as always, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We're also going to take questions and stories from patients and staff here in the Clark Auditorium at the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And we begin with Navy Commander Dr. Richard Jadick. He's in Fallujah during the intense battle for that city in November 2004. He received the Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor. He's still on active duty in the Navy and joins us here at the Bethesda Naval Hospital. He wrote a book about his experiences called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Now, when you signed up to go to Iraq as a battalion surgeon, did you know you were going to get into Fallujah?
No. At the time when I signed up to go to Iraq, it was a time when I thought I was going over there for a brief period. Mm-hmm. I was going over with the battalion who I had been the MEU surgeon for. I had actually been the senior medical officer on a float before that. So I knew the battalion. And
a MEU is a Marine Expeditionary Unit.
Yes.
And a float, you're usually at sea.
Yes.
Okay.
And I apologize that I look at all the uniforms and it's easy to say those words. And I had known the battalion, and I had known them well. When the battalion was going over, they had no physician support, and I said I would go, and really, the honest truth is I was going to go for a couple of months, and they were going to replace me, but, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, and that's what the division surgeon said to me when I called him. I said, hey, you're going to bring me home? He said, sorry, you're already over there, so I stayed.
Yeah. There's a fascinating there's a lot of fascinating passages in your book, but one of them you describe rolling into Fallujah and the moment where you saw your first injured man and felt like you froze for a second, like you couldn't get out of the car.
Well, yeah, I was in the back of an armored ambulance at that point. It was a track from Vietnam, actually, that the Army had, the West Virginia National Guard had brought over and had lent us. And when the track door opened, the chaos that was going on, there was RPGs going off, and one hit the track. It didn't go off. It just hit the track, and some insurgents were at the back of the track. And I looked out at this chaos, if it weren't for that, I had a complete fear. If it was not for the fear of failure, which as I looked out and I saw these Marines and the corpsman that was at that point, H.N. Lambot, was outside, I looked out, and if it wasn't for my fear of failing these people out there, I would not have gotten off that track. And I can see where fear can freeze you, and it did to me.
And Dr. Jadick, at that moment, you also learned the meaning of the word triage.
Yes. Triage, for anybody who doesn't understand it, is the French word to sort, and it's paramount in what we do when we have many men who are wounded, or men and women who are wounded, and we go out onto a scene, and then you have to categorize who gets treated and who doesn't. It makes sense, and I trained all the corpsmen how to do it, and I trained them what to look for and what things not to treat, because we're not going to be able to effectually save those people. And you try and put the most resources towards the people you can intervene positively on. And when I got out and I saw my first Marine, he was bleeding significantly from a groin wound. And I spent some time with him, but not a lot of time, because as he was alive at that point, he did not make it, because I couldn't stop the bleeding. And there's a point where you have to move on. I had six other wounded Marines on the ground around me, and we did. We moved on to them. Unfortunately, and you think about this every day, I think about it every day. Did I spend enough time? Did I put enough time? Did I put enough effort into it? To sort is an easy word to talk about in the textbooks, and when you put it on a chart and you say, look at this and don't look at this and move on from this. But when you know these Marines and you know these people, it's a different story.
One of the things that you did that turned out that really did work was to move your operation into the city under fire. This is not just you, of course. It's your whole team.
Yes. Nothing in the book goes into that explicitly. Nothing you do is by yourself. I think the Newsweek article that they wrote was a little off-center, and it really emphasized me, but I had a team of 54 corpsmen and a battalion of 964 Marines that surrounded me and enabled me to do the things that we did. And moving into the city was one of those things. To me, as time went on and I saw that the types of wounds we were seeing were causing men to die were head wounds, groin wounds, and axillary wounds that we could intervene with.
Axillary wounds?
Wounds in the armpit.
Just because of the body armor?
Because the body armor was protecting their torso. So we were getting extremity injuries. And these are things that if you're there on time and you're there to intervene, you can save their lives very easily. None of it's rocket science. It's, mm-hmm. You stop bleeding. But if you wait for that person to get evacuated to you to stop that bleeding, then by then it's usually too late.
Mm-hmm. As you went through this experience, and this was one of the maybe the most violent and intense series of combat days anywhere in Iraq, as you went through this experience, what do you think you learned that you can bring back and pass on to other people who might be in your situation?
Some of the things that I think we were able to actually learn and expand upon were realizing that, trauma, there's a golden hour, and we talk about the golden hour, and as physicians, we talk about the golden hour, but when you talk to Marines and commanders about the golden hour, that's what they mm-hmm. focus on. They say, well, if I get my Marine back to medical facility within an hour, they're going to live, and if I don't, they're going to die. And I think when you're starting to talk about penetrating trauma and trauma in a combat scenario, really the mantra should be the right people at the right place at the right time, and the right time is as quickly as possible. And putting your medical assets as far forward as you possibly can, as long as they are secure and the assets are capable of not becoming a hindrance, then you're going to do those three things. You're going to have the right people at the right place at the right time, and that's going to effectually allow you to intervene much mm-hmm. more on more of these injuries than before.
Let's bring in Jeremy Moore. He's a hospital corpsman, second class, to us lay people. Just corpsman will do. He's a medic. He's one of the first people to respond when the call comes in that there are casualties. He was in Iraq for 7 months in 2005. Nice to have you on the program as well.
Thank you, sir.
And tell us about your job. You flew in helicopters as part of the evacuation mission?
Yes, sir. As part of the evacuation mission, we flew in CH-46 helicopters. Mm-hmm. We would fly in. We could carry 16 patients, so we would fly in. Whenever we got a call, kind of like a firehouse type thing, we would sit around and wait. Once we got that call, we would take off and pick up the patients from wherever they were at in Iraq and take them mm-hmm. To a higher echelon of care.
Yeah. CH-46, no doubt everybody knows they're older than you. Fact is, a lot of them are older than me.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. These are elderly. Sir, as you were doing this, flying into places, I assume every once in a while somebody would shoot at you.
Oh, yes, sir. All the time.
All the time.
It wasn't that bad to see during the day. At night, you could see it a lot better.
And how many in your team?
We had 40 actually in our team as far as CASVAC corpsmen, but as far as on the helicopter, there were 7 of us on each helicopter. We flew 2 helicopters.
Were you guys armed?
Each 46 had 250 caliber
machine guns,
and then every person had a contingent of their own sidearms, yeah. Whether 9mm or M16s, in case something happened, we went down.
And did you ever have to use it?
We did use the 50 cals. We never had to use our personal sidearms.
Mm-hmm. That's Dr. Jadig, I know you had a moment like this where you saw a muzzle flash of a sniper firing and said, would you guys go over and take care of that, please? But there's a moment where you're medics. You're supposed to help people.
Right. I there is a moment. You think about it afterwards. I, again, didn't think about it much because we were in a parking lot, and once you see muzzle flash, and it was a directed muzzle flash, you're pretty sure that the aim is in your direction or close enough. And we were taking enough rounds around from snipers to know that, that if you saw that flash, you needed to let somebody know. So I will be honest with you, I didn't wrestle with the Hippocratic Oath and do no harm. At that point, I said, hey, you guys, you're Marines, do something about that. And they did. And in typical Marine fashion, they lined up a load of gun trucks and went out and took care of the sniper. Snipers are a very dangerous element, and they need to be they needed to be cared for quickly because they hurt morale. Mm-hmm. And they can easily wound with one shot. So. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Navy Commander Dr. Richard Juddick and also with us HM2 Jeremy Moore. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We're also going to take questions by email, talk@npr.org. We're going to take questions from here in the hall as well. And I want to begin on the phone, and if we can, there we go, Don. Don's on the line with us from Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get through this. It's kind of an emotional thing for me, but my son first has joined the Marine Corps. He'll be shipping off May 21st. And my daughter has signed up for the Navy. She'll be leaving July 11th. And she's going to be an air crewman on a helicopter with aspirations of going into the Medical Corps. Does anybody have any words of advice for me, my daughter, and my son?
I don't know.
The only two I have.
Yes. First of all, Jeremy Moore, what tell them what's it like on a helicopter?
Life on a helicopter is pretty nice as far as things you get to see, and it's not as bad as it sounds because you always hear of a helicopter going down somewhere, but it's not like that. You hear of the few things that are bad. You don't hear of the tons of things that are good. But I think that if she wants to do air crew, that's fine. I would just suggest that she start swimming now.
Okay, she does that.
Not that she'll need it, but the training is quite vigorous right. As far as swimming.
Mm-hmm. Can we leave you on the hold for a second for Don? Because we have to take a short break. All right,
sure.
We'll get to the other point that you had when we come back. We're here at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, the National Naval Medical Center, for a special broadcast of Talk of the Nation, talking about acute medical care on the battlefield. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Conan, and we're having a special broadcast today from the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. This is the hospital where many of the combat wounded from Iraq and Afghanistan are brought for treatment, but medical care begins on the front lines with doctors, nurses, and corpsmen who respond. We have some of them with us today. With us is Navy Commander Dr. Richard Juddick. He's a combat doctor. I got it wrong again, didn't I?
Oh, that was right. That was good.
That was good. Okay. Yeah, he was a combat doctor in Fallujah, Iraq in 2004, wrote the book On Call in Hell. Also, hospital corpsman, second class, Jeremy Moore is with us, who served as a corpsman in Iraq. We want to hear from those of you here in the auditorium and on the phone. If you or a family member served in Iraq and Afghanistan, received medical treatment there, call and tell us what it was like. Did it work? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Our blog is at npr.org/blogofthenation. Still with us on the line from Lansing, Michigan is Don, and he had a question about a daughter who was signed up to be a corpsman and on helicopter duty, and a son who's in the Marine Corps. Dr. Juddick, you were in the Marines as well.
Yes, sir. I will tell you, sir, that one of the things that you have to understand is that they're going to become highly trained. What they do will be taught to them time and again, and they will go over with a good team. They will go over anywhere they go with friends, comrades, people who will be dedicated to only them. They become a family. So you have to leave some of that parenting instinct behind as they go off. As far as the medical corps, I know. As far as the medical corps goes, let me tell you, I was a Marine for 6 years. I never thought I'd become a doctor. And, you know, as time goes on, all things can happen. It happened for me. I'm still a resident. I'm 42 years old and still a resident. So I'm probably the oldest urology resident in the country. But you can do it if you want.
Okay. Don, I'm not sure that's much comfort, but we wish your son and your daughter the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call.
Bye-bye.
Let's see if we can get a question from here in the audience. Sir?
So, Ensign Decker, I'm a first-year medical student over at Uniformed Services University, and I was just wondering, how in the military medical community are we addressing the use of data collection and analysis so that all of these improvements that we're seeing over there every day can be implemented throughout the whole worldwide medical community?
Let me say, the Uniformed Services University is sort of the military's medical school. Is that about right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Dr. Jaddick?
Well, you know, I will be honest with you. You know, we kept, for us, there is the post-deployment health assessment form that everybody does. There was also a logbook of all the injuries that were non-battle sustained injuries. Once we lost a lot of our data, you know, in the battlefield as you're treating patients. So some of those log entries were passed up, but I'm not sure sometimes how much we missed some of that. There are a lot of programs afoot to put some data out on the battlefield, and I am not sure how those are working out, and maybe some of the other panelists can answer some of those questions.
Well, let me introduce now Commander Tina Ortiz, a nurse who served 3 months in a field hospital near the combat zone in Jalabar in Iraq. She's also with us here at the National Naval Medical Center. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me. My other job is as the executive officer of NIMIC, which is the National Medical Information Management Center, and one of the programs that we have there is the electronic medical record. And we are currently using the electronic medical record in Kuwait now at our military medical facility there, and it is being used in Monstool where the patients are transferred to.
That's in Germany,
and then
yeah.
And eventually here to in Bethesda and San Diego where the patients go to. So there is a tracking of the patient's care that starts on the battlefield and goes through to their first stop at the field hospital, and then from there all the way here to Bethesda. So there is information regarding that, and certainly all of our lessons learned are being documented, and then that information is being kept, and that data is being transferred and certainly being collected for lessons learned.
Thanks for the question. Let's go back to the phones and see if we can get to. Okay. Let's. There we go. Jason. Jason's with us from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi, Jason.
So, my call is the first one I want to say how thankful I am for. The time and the air crews that work on soldiers that need to rescue from a combat zone. The story I wanted to share was that on one particular mission that my platoon was on, one of my soldiers was mortally wounded, shot in the face. And during that mission, I called the 9-line medevac, and within 10 minutes, the helicopter had arrived from the point of when I had sent the transmission to when he was picked up. And I attribute the speed as to why he was able to survive, and, you know, thankfully he's still serving today. In fact, he just got promoted. But it was just an absolute miracle that he was able to, you know, the kind of wound he sustained and to be rescued, and now he's literally living a normal life now.
And it sounds as if there's tremendous relief in your voice. Obviously, losing somebody, there's nothing worse than that.
Absolutely.
I wondered, Dr. Jaddick?
Well, I mean, I can say that, you know, the HM2 Moore I knew back in 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines when I was there. And these air crews, these guys who fly in, are angels. I mean, they come anywhere and they do anything to get to you. It's funny because you always hear the warning, don't call them into a hot zone, don't call them into a hot zone. And time and again, and not in Fallujah because we did not have helicopter support in Fallujah, but out in and in around Haditha when we had wounded Marines, there was no such thing as a hot zone. The Army Black Hawk pilots and the Marine pilots flew to wherever they needed to be and would tell you, just don't worry, Pop Smoke, and we'll be there. And you know, I can't say enough for them. It's because of these guys like this, that people are making it back to Echelon 2 and further on care.
I wonder, Jeremy Moore, as you're going into a situation like that, does anybody in the back say, uh-uh?
If we do, it's more of a collaborative issue between everybody. The pilots are very good about finding safe ways for us to come in, especially in hot zones. Anything that they think might be dangerous, but they will ask us if it is extremely dangerous, should we go in.
Mm-hmm.
We trained together for a year before we even left, and when we weren't training, we were actually flying the missions. So we were constantly going through our heads, worst-case scenario, what we were doing. So everybody was expecting the worst and hoping for the best for everything. So it wasn't that bad. Once it came to where we were at, everybody was so compassionate and was actually ready to go in and get whoever it was and bring them out, that it wasn't, I don't think it was ever any hesitation or second thoughts mm-hmm. as to going in.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. I wonder, Commander Ortiz, you were on the sort of the receiving end when people like those C-46s came in with the wounded, and what kind of difference did it make that they got there quickly?
It made a big difference because we saw patients come in and they brought them very, very quickly to us. They oftentimes flew directly from the point of pickup to us, and so we would bring them in. We picked them up. Our drop-off zone was a little bit different, a distance from where our tent hospital was, so that, of course, they wouldn't blow our tents apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so our ambulances would go out, pick them up from the helicopter, bring them in to our receiving area. Our staff would respond very quickly, triage them, and then we would get them into the operating room or down to the intensive care unit very, very quickly. And so our survival rate was also quite excellent. Our facility saw, in the 3 short months that we were there, saw over 1,100 patients.
Wow.
And a good number of those patients were actually transferred over to the Comfort.
USNS Comfort, the Naval Hospital
yes,
ship.
Yes, yeah. And for the very first time ever, those patients, many of them came back to us, and we did kind of a reverse echelon of care. They came back to us, and then we took care of them again, and then we transferred them back to Baghdad and to other hospitals because we took care of a large number of enemy prisoners of war as well as displaced civilians.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go with... There we go. I think, did we get it there? Naseem. Naseem is with
yes.
us from Akron, Ohio. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, as a medical doctor, if you came upon an Iraqi soldier that was injured by an American soldier, would you assist them?
Yeah, and that happened.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. That happened to me on several occasions. I mean, that was, that's the oath we swear, and that was the rules of engagement. We treated everybody who came through. And it didn't matter what the injury or how the injury got there. Now, certainly, there were prisoners, and there were just displaced personnel, and I treated every one of them. I treated over 50 prisoners and over 100 Iraqi civilians within the first 2 weeks that we were in downtown Fallujah. So, yes, we do, and I gave them everything I had as far as medical care. I never worried about not being able to be resupplied because we were always resupplied very quickly, and I never had to pay, steal from Peter to pay Paul or any.
Was it part of your triage thought process at all? All things considered equal, would you take the Marine before you took the Iraqi?
Now, that is a situation that never came to me where I had one and one of exactly the same wound where I had to treat. One's life would be saved and one's would be lost. I am prepared to make that decision, but that is a very personal decision. That's something that I wouldn't talk about here.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for the call, Ms.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Let's see if we can get another question from here in the audience in Bethesda. Sir.
Hi. I'm sorry about my voice. I'm Special Slavey. I served in Iraq at the end of 2006 and beginning of 2007, and I was in actually Fallujah, and I got shot by a sniper, and I was ground medevaced back to Camp Fallujah, and we were only like maybe a 10-minute drive away. And I'd like to say that, as soon as I got shot, it was out of my hands, and I had absolutely no doubt in my mind that they were going to do everything they could for me. And it was like, I knew I'd be fine, whether I was going to be or not. I just knew myself. And to go with the choppers, the Blackhawks especially, or whoever, they really have no fear at all. They'll go into anything. And we've had a lot of guys saved because they really have no regard for their own lives, I guess. They'll do whatever it takes.
I suspect they do have some regard for their lives, but also for yours.
Sorry, I didn't. That came out wrong, I guess.
That's okay, but I just wanted to follow up and ask you, with that knowledge, with that belief, does that make it easier to go out into dangerous situations?
It made me a lot more comfortable. I think it might have been a little bit false, but I mean, it makes you feel better knowing that, you know, there's going to be someone there right away, and it's not up to you anymore. And these people are well trained, you know. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for the question. We're speaking today about battlefield medics with Commander Dr. Richard Jaddick, and also Jeremy Moore, who's a hospital corpsman second class, also with his Commander Tina Ortiz, who served as a nurse 3 months at a field hospital near the combat zone in Iraq. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And go back to the phone, and this is all right. There we go, William. William's with us from San Antonio in Texas.
How are you doing today, sir?
Okay, I'm well.
First thing I like to say to all the combat medics, doctors, they do a wonderful job. And I was stationed in Afghanistan and along the Pakistani border in the Tora Bora Mountain region. I had gotten wounded in the chest. And unfortunately, they were unable to land the helicopter, which was a Chinook, to airlift me out. And just watching the helicopter when they were trying to get it in was scary enough. They were getting so close to the mountains. I don't know how the pilot did it. And they fashioned a basket to lift me out to get me to a cache medical facility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when a lot of people, what I guess they don't understand, you know, for when you're in war, you can't get a really simple, like, 5-cent item, you know, at the corner store. And where they are well supplied, it was just amazing how doctors and nurses could fashion or, I guess, rig up items, you know, to serve the purposes to take care of the soldiers. I mean, it's almost like they're part engineer, part doctors.
Commander Ortiz, I see Commander Ortiz nodding her head with some recognition. Can you fill us in on something that may have happened to you along those lines?
Well, I was laughing because the Iraq deployment was my second deployment, and the first one was during the Haitian crisis, and I was in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and both times when we opened our, what they call our pack out, we found items that were quite old, and because they do the pack outs quite in advance and were unusable, and so we had to become very imaginative. And one thing that I can say about nurses is that they are very imaginative, and they can figure out ways to put things together. And the Iraqi folks are very private individuals, especially the women, of course. They keep themselves very covered, and so when we did rounds, we had to be able to maintain their privacy. And of course, we're talking of a hospital where it was open bay. So we figured out a way to fashion these individual curtains hanging off of the sides of the rails of the inside of this tent, and we would hang them all around the sides, and we actually made it so that it was one side of it would disconnect, and we could then move it over and connect to the other side and then connect it to the other side. And so we would do rounds this way, and we would actually bring a chair around, and one nurse would get up and continuously do this with moving this curtain around as we did these rounds with the physicians in order to ensure this privacy for our female patients. And it was almost comical the way we were swinging this curtain around, but we were always continuously ensuring this privacy. And this was just one of many examples of the way that we adapted things to make them work for us in this type of environment where maybe some supplies were, it wasn't that they were limited, we just didn't have exactly what we needed for the situation that we were in.
William, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
No, thanks.
And we'd like to thank Jeremy Moore and Commander Ortiz, our guests, for being with us today. And Dr. Jadak, if you would stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk some about the psychology with a military psychologist who's treating the emotional wounds of the war. So stay with us. I'm Neil Conan, and we're doing a special broadcast today from the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan at the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. And here are the headlines from some of the other stories we're following at NPR News today. Six foreign-born Muslims have been arrested for plotting an attack on the Fort Dix Army Post in New Jersey. Investigators say the men planned to kill as many soldiers as possible in attacks with grenades, rocket launchers, and guns. Former enemies representing opposite sides of the political spectrum launched a new power-sharing government in Northern Ireland today. Hardline unionists who want Northern Ireland to continue to be part of Britain and hardline Republicans who support a united Ireland pledged to work together for peace and stability. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, some of the first schools to use laptops to help students learn now say it's not working. We'll look at what changed their minds. No laptop left behind. Plus, we'll talk with Republican presidential hopeful Tommy Thompson. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. And now we're going to continue our conversation about doctors on the front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan. U.S. troops injured in Iraq or Afghanistan get more rapid treatment than in any war in history, something our guest knows well. Navy Commander Dr. Richard Jadak was combat doctor in Fallujah in 2004. He received the Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor. I should mention he's still on active duty. In a moment, we'll hear from a military psychologist about treating mental health in combat. If you or a family member served in Iraq or Afghanistan, if you have stories or questions about medical treatment there, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And joining us now is Lieutenant Commander Tara Smith. She's a psychologist who was assigned to the Army's 113th Medical Company. She provided mental health services, education, and debriefing to combat troops to prevent and treat post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it's nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, sir.
And I wanted to begin by asking, from the experiences that we've been hearing from just these people, it's not just the soldiers and the Marines out in the field who have, these are very intense experiences people are describing. Don't the medics have some problems with this, with PTSD as well?
Oh, yes, sir. Everyone from the chaplains to the physicians to the nurses to the medics also experience the same environmental stressors and physical stressors as the soldiers going outside the wire.
And how do you how can you prevent this short of getting people out of conflict?
We do our best to have a presence in the units to help them gain their trust and establish credibility and educate them as best as possible on how to cope effectively, mm-hmm. and what kind of things to avoid when they're trying to cope, and reassure them that their reactions are absolutely normal given the circumstances.
And is this something that's dealt with on a one-to-one basis, or is there some way to try to treat people in large groups?
We try to do both. When we're working with the units to have leadership there is very vital to encouraging the soldiers to come forward and seek further attention if they need it.
And that's sometimes difficult, I would think.
There's a stigma associated with mental health and in the military world as well as the civilian world, and so we're always trying to combat that stigma. And again, if we have a presence in the unit, that tends to minimize the stigma associated with seeking care.
But how do you go about doing that? I mean, it's difficult in civilian life. Certainly in the military, it's got to be much more difficult.
What's different in Iraq is that psychologists are actually going to go to the motor pool where the soldiers are working on vehicles and get under the vehicle with them and just spend time with them to help them get accustomed to talking to us so that when they really do need us, they don't have that fear associated with coming in for mental health care.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, given your experience, just out being out there with them, that's got to help too.
Absolutely.
I wonder, Dr. Jadak, I know that in your experience, you talked about the importance of going on patrol with the Marines, being as close to them as possible. As a former Marine yourself, I know that this was helpful. And I know that you've had some problems with, I don't know whether it was PTSD itself, but certainly a lot of nightmares after you got back.
Well, I don't think anybody goes over there without coming back with what I call ghosts. It affects you no matter. You're a changed person when you come back. You've seen so much and done so much that these things do sit in your head, and at times they come out. And for me, it was at night, and at times they still come out. However, I know that when I came back, that there was always the availability for help mm-hmm. everywhere I went. And when I was out with the Marines, we had a regimental psychiatrist who came and came up to our position, somebody I liked very much, who I trusted very much. So it was easy to put confidence into the corpsmen to get out into their groups. And, you know, there's so live line company corpsmen who are with all the Marines all the time. Marines don't necessarily want to talk mental health, but getting the corpsmen out there was and then the corpsmen trusted the psychiatrist who was out there all the time. So what we're talking about is working, and it works out in the field right now.
Mm-hmm. And Commander Smith, I assume this is a team effort. This is not something that one individual does.
Yes, sir. We worked in combat stress control teams, which were usually a team of a provider, whether it be a psychiatrist, psychologist, or social worker, and a medic who would spend time visiting all of the units in their workplaces, in the dining facilities, at the gym. We would go everywhere the soldiers were and the Marines were, again, to get them accustomed to seeing us and talking mm-hmm. to us.
And getting over that difficulty of explaining, you know, the stigma, as you say, and it certainly is a stigma in civilian life, and certainly in the Marine Corps, it's got to be even more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the stigma of being, well, anyway, let's see if we can get some more callers on the line. And again, we encourage those of you here in the audience, if you have questions, to join us. Let's go to, this is Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Chris is with us from Valdosta in Georgia.
Yes, sorry to revert back to the previous subject. I was here when you were on your commercial break.
We don't have commercials. It's public radio.
I'm a former combat rescue pilot here at Moody Air Force Base in Georgia. And just to let you know, that I've heard the fact that Marine and Army helicopters are mentioned for combat recoveries, but also the U.S. Air Force is there doing pretty important work. Oftentimes, if the combat zone is a little too hot, the Army will Rescue Coordination Center will pass the request off to the Air Force, and the Air Force will go in because we have a little bit more robust self-protection systems on the aircraft and to make the recovery as well. So that's really all I want to pass along, and really doesn't matter whether they are Americans or Iraqis, combat wounded Americans or prisoners, we'll go in and do what we need to do to effect a recovery and so that those people can live.
Okay. Chris, thanks very much for straightening us out, and thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
So long. Let's see if we can go now to Ann. And Ann is with us from Cincinnati. Ann, are you there? I'll learn how to push this button on this remote computer soon. It's an important skill, button pushing. There we go. Ann, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Ann, go ahead, please.
I have a nephew who's come back with fallujah with post-traumatic stress disorder. But more importantly, in my training for clinical psychology, I treated Vietnam vets at a VA hospital. And I don't think this is reported much, and it gets to the issue of stigma. It mm-hmm. seems that in doing the history, a lot of these vets had very Norman Rockwell upbringings, strong sense of right and wrong, many very religious, and their main symptom of their post-traumatic stress disorder was intense guilt over some of the things that they did in Vietnam that 30, 40 years later they can't reconcile. And obviously in the fog of war and so forth, there are lots of things people have to do, but I think it's particularly relevant given the report that just came out this week about the number of things that the soldiers will do in combat might be considered, you know, mild atrocities or violating norms, that when you're in a war and that's the only thing you can control, you may do, but when you come back and reflect on it, particularly if you're a real straight shooter to begin with, it is very, very difficult to reconcile it. And I was wondering if that issue is being looked at, that it's not the people who are pre-morbidly or pre-war emotionally kind of off kilter. It's sometimes the ones who are so stable and so firm and have one worldview that it just knocks them off their pins and they don't recover.
Commander Smith?
Well, I think the experience of war pulls the rug out from anyone's feet who is going through it. We deal with the issue of guilt in group environments. After a traumatic event, we'll sit down and talk with the units and discuss their experiences and help them put it in the context of chain of command duty, mission. People don't make decisions alone, oftentimes in theater. How much of the guilt is rational? How much of it is realistic? What's a better use of their resources? Rather than blaming themselves, how can they help each other cope, reach out to the families that were affected if they have survivor's guilt, and just try to put it in a better context to help them cope more effectively instead of tearing themselves apart with the guilt.
Oh, good you do address that. That's so important, I think.
And another thing, I know that this has become a much more recognized factor, PTSD, in these days than it was in Vietnam. And in fact, I think some of the people Anne may be talking about did not have it treated back then. And the demons will always find a way to emerge at some point.
We actually have a few Vietnam veterans serving in Iraq, and oftentimes they would come by one of our centers and share their experiences with the younger soldiers and Marines, and that was beyond effective and valuable to help them understand how much more resources they really do have now compared to the Vietnam era. And to hear a Vietnam veteran who has so much credibility among the soldiers and Marines say how fortunate they are to have us there in Iraq to help them went a long way to helping our mission.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jadak, I think I stole that line from you about the demons always coming out. I think I read that in your book.
I mean, you may have. I haven't read the book in a long time. So, but I mean, the truth is that these things need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed for these guys who are coming home as soon as possible. It starts with their family, but it also starts with their units getting involved in what they're doing and how they're interacting with other people and what has changed. They're going to be changed, but intervention sooner is going to make for a better outcome.
Yeah, and I know that you've kept in touch with a lot of the people who were with your unit in Fallujah, and some of them are doing well, and some of them had difficulties.
Almost to a man, they all had some difficulties, but they were all strong, strong enough to get some help, and have actually, all of them seem to be doing very well. A lot of them have gotten out, and some of them have gone back for second and third tours. So I don't know what the spectrum is that people do to get better, but getting help and understanding their problems is the first step.
All right. Anne, thanks very much for the call,
thank
and good so luck
much.
To
You're
you.
You're encouraging. Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're speaking with Navy Commander Dr. Richard Jadak, a combat doctor in Iraq from May 2004 to January 2005. Also with us, Commander Tara Smith, who's a psychologist assigned to the Army 113th Medical Company, October 2006 through April 2007, and provided mental health services in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask to some degree about what improvements can be made as we look ahead to this conflict is not over, and there are going to be other situations. And, Dr. Jadak, I know that in your book you suggested that the way the military gets its doctors, it ought to look into maybe finding new ways to getting some of its doctors.
Well, as I discussed this in the book, the thought process is that sometimes we're throwing money to get doctors to come in, and that works sometimes.
Subsidizing medical school.
Instead of them understanding exactly what they're getting into, one of the reasons I wrote the book is so that those physicians who do come in, or those medical students who decide to go through the USIS program or to take the scholarship money in a civilian program, is that they understand that they may be asked to do the things that hopefully not some of the things that I went through, but they will be asked to deploy, and they will be asked to be a naval officer, I happen to be Navy, but to be an officer and a leader as well as a physician. And sometimes I think in the medical corps that does get lost because there's just so much training involved in being a physician that when they get sent out to an operational unit, the leadership part tends to be
the officer part.
Lackluster. The officer part seems to be a little less.
In fact, you said in your book one of the reasons you wrote it was to deter some people from becoming medical, military medical.
In my experiences, I've seen quite a few people come to me asking me if I thought that the Navy or the Army scholarship was a great way to go through medical school. And for me, it was. It was a great way. I love everything I do, and I love the Navy. I love the Marine Corps. I love the service. But for some of these people, I looked them straight in the face, and it's not about the money. You can't go into this thing looking at it for the money. You have to look at it because this is what you want to do. There's more to it than just that, and I've deterred some myself, saying I don't think this is a good position for you.
At the same time, you also suggest to the military that they might want to look to people like yourself who served as a Marine or to corpsmen for candidates, even if they turn out to be 43-year-old residents.
We have an amazing pool of people in uniform who are smart, enlisted officer alike, and they can step up and become physicians. They can do these things that in the medical side of the house that I don't think we give them the opportunity to do. I know for a fact that I've had several calls about people who are college graduates in the Navy, chiefs, HM1s, who've asked me, well, can I go to medical school? Sure. Take the MCAT. And I know that when I was going through that process, I didn't have anybody to guide me or give me any kind of understanding of what was going on, and sometimes you just get in the rut saying, I just can't do that. And that's one of the things I think I try and emphasize as well, is that I did it. Anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm. You're in uniform today, but at the moment you're working down in Georgia as a resident urologist?
That's correct. I am a PGY4, a postgraduate year 4. I'm a fourth year resident at the Medical College of Georgia down in Augusta. I am not a full board certified urologist at this point. I'm still learning the trade, and at 42, I think I am the oldest urology resident in the country.
And you still owe the Navy some years.
Yeah, then I owe 4 more years after that. So.
Yeah.
So I've got 17 years in, and there is nothing for me personally. There's nothing I would rather do than put this uniform on and come and work with men and women in uniform.
And if the opportunity if came up to be a battalion surgeon again in Iraq?
Well, and I look around, make sure my wife's not out there. But I will tell you that it's the best job as far as I'm concerned, best job in the Navy. And I would do it again if it was so asked. I don't think they would send a urologist out there as a battalion surgeon anymore, but I would deploy again. I expect to deploy again, I guess, if that comes up. I'm very happy to be home with my family every night and to be able to see them. But if push comes to shove, that's what I got to do. That's what I got to do.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today.
Appreciate
your time.
Thank you.
That is Commander Dr. Richard Jaddick, whose book is On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. We'd also like to thank Lieutenant Commander Tara Smith, a psychologist who was served in Iraq and was kind enough to also join us here at the Clark Auditorium at the National Naval Medical Center, known to civilians who live around here as the Bethesda Naval Hospital. We appreciate your time today as well. We thank all of you in the audience who took your time to be with us and kindly provided us with your questions. I'm sorry I didn't see you there. We would have gotten to your question if I had. I apologize for that. We'd like to thank some of the people who are involved in this broadcast, which was produced by Susan Lund and Becky Vlamis, our engineers, Kim Jones, Neil Ellis. We'd like to thank the entire staff at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, especially Brian Badura, Ellen Crown, and Rear Admiral Adam Robinson, the commander at the National Naval Medical Center. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Bethesda.